These are biological diagrams that show the male and female genitalia.
Yeah. You know, I have all these, you know, for explanation and information. Sometimes I have to show it to people.
This is Assignment on the BBC World Service. I'm Yolande Nell, and this week I'm at the clinic of groundbreaking Israeli sex therapist Ronit Aloni.
You've also got some erotic artwork here.
Well, I have... This is different positioning, sexual positioning.
We're in her small, informal consultation room. And there's nothing too surprising here. She has an armchair which faces a small, comfy couch for her patients. But it's what happens in the neighbouring room that's more unusual.
In this area, which is the surrogate section... You know, it doesn't look like hotel. It looks more like a house, like an apartment, and, you know.
Just next door is this small room where you've got a sofa bed, you've got a CD player, people can play their music, a small bathroom with a shower, and people can get intimate.
Yeah.
This is where paid surrogate partners meet Ronit's patients. They help teach them how to have intimate relationships and, ultimately, how to have sex. While the therapy is used around the world, in most countries it's seen as fringe and highly controversial. It's only in Israel that it's become mainstream, to the extent that the state covers the high cost for soldiers with injuries affecting their sexual performance.
Connecting yourself as a human being is connecting yourself to your sexuality. And people need to feel that they can be of worth to somebody else, that they can pleasure somebody else, and then that they can get pleasure from somebody else. Otherwise, why they want to stay alive?
I'm in Tel Aviv, looking at sexual healing for Israel's disabled war veterans, and to hear from a woman trying to convince the world that sex surrogacy works.
There's a steady stream of people of all different ages and backgrounds coming in to see Ronit discreetly here at the clinic. Ronit herself is an attractive woman in her 60s with a wide smile. What makes her look particularly striking is her long, dark, curly hair with a shock of white at the front. She's full of energy, as if she's on a mission.
You know, we expect people to know about sexuality without teaching them, all right? And this is weird because we teach everything but sexuality. This is the only thing we leave for porn to teach us, which is a very bad way to learn about sexuality.
Many of those seeking help here are struggling to have a romantic relationship because of intimacy issues or anxiety. Others have suffered sexual abuse or trauma. Then there are people with physical and mental health conditions. Ronit's focused on disabled patients since the start of her career. She says her interest began because of her family experiences, including her father's brain injury.
My father was the pilot. He crashed with an airplane and was rehabilitated. My grandfather was having hand amputee. And my youngest sister, she was having a genetic disease like cystic fibrosis. And so I, all my life, was next to people who was having to deal with and struggle with and overcome different disabilities. And all these people were very well rehabilitated. And so I had this very optimistic approach to disabilities.
Ronit's credentials include a doctorate in sexual rehabilitation. She studied in New York, and it was there that she came across sex surrogacy, becoming close to a surrogate who worked with disabled people. When she returned to Israel in the late 1980s, she brought the practice back with her. Since then, she's used it to help about 1,000 patients.
Why use surrogates as part of therapy?
Because sex therapy is, in many ways, it's couple therapies. And if somebody doesn't have a partner, doesn't matter if it's a man or a woman, then you cannot complete the process of the therapy without a partner. She or he, if it's a surrogate, they are there to model the partner role in a couple.
What are the rules of surrogacy that you set?
Well, it's a triangle. It's three people who work together. It's the patient, it's the surrogate, and it's the therapist like me who control and direct and change some of the habits so that it will work for them. The meetings at the beginning takes place in public places. It can be in restaurants, on the beach, in the parks, so they get to feel comfortable with each other. Then they move into the clinic, and there they continue to do the more intimate part of the therapy, which starts from touching maybe the palm, depends on the amount of anxiety.
But there's something I have to ask.
There will be people who question the whole idea of using surrogates, paying them to have sex with your patients. I mean, how is it different from prostitution?
Well, there is nothing similar to prostitution. So it's really so flat to ask. I'm sorry that I say it, but it's really not understanding, because people that come to surrogate therapy, they are coming for therapy. They are not coming for pleasure. And also, 85% of the sessions are not directed to sexuality. It's to intimacy, it's to touching, it's to giving, it's to receiving, it's communicating, it's learning how the other person feels and how do you respond to that. And it's about learning to be a person, a human being, and how you relate to other people. So by the time you have sexual relationship, that's the end of the process.
I've come now into the heart of Tel Aviv, where the main roads thread through rows of towering skyscrapers with giant advertising billboards mounted on them. But this isn't just a commercial city, it's a military one too. Young men and women in olive green uniforms with guns strapped over their shoulders chat as they stride by into the large army base here. At 18, most eligible Israelis do compulsory military service, and they can continue as reserve soldiers into middle age.
In the sex clinic building, I'm meeting a man who had a life-changing accident when he was a reservist nearly 30 years ago. He's wearing a tracksuit, ready to play table tennis, and is in a wheelchair. We're trying and failing to find a quiet spot to discuss his private life away from the cleaners, changing bin bags.
It's a nylon can. That's in the army when you have some, in the evening, you have some sweet from home and you want to eat it by yourself.
Makes this rustling noise. Yeah, that's not very good.
To protect his identity, I'm calling my interviewee Mr. A. When he fell from a height and broke his back, he was left paralysed from the waist down. He was one of the first to get the Ministry of Defence to fund his sex surrogacy treatment.
When I was injured, I make a list to do. I have to do a shower by myself. I have to eat by myself, to dress by myself, to drive by myself. And I have to make sex by myself, you know, not by myself, but independently.
At the time, Mr. A was already married with children. His wife's always supported him, but didn't feel comfortable talking about sex to doctors and therapists. She preferred for him to seek help alone from Ranit and work with a surrogate.
I asked my wife to join me to do the rehabilitation in sex, but it doesn't suit to her values, to her feelings. She was a private person. She said, "You were injured. So it's fine with me if you are doing it with another lady." She signed it. She's very happy that I will do the procedure. And that's what I did.
And what can you tell us about the treatment?
It was a nice treatment, to be honest. You know, you start from the beginning, you're touching this, you're touching there, and then it's a building by step till the last stage of getting sort of orgasm.
And Dr. Ranit talks to you and to the surrogate,
yes,
all the way through?
Yes. Yes, every session is that you meet the lady, the surrogate. You do what Ranit told you to do. And then you're going out and everybody is telling what he's feeling. And she tells, okay, thank you for telling, and she continued to the next stage. And after it's finished, it's finished.
Mr. A is very matter-of-fact about what he went through, and he says it was right for the state to pay for his weekly sessions over 3 months, just as it did other parts of his rehabilitation. At today's rates, the monthly cost was about $1,800.
It wasn't the goal of my life to go to a surrogate. Okay, I was injured, and I want to rehabilitate in every aspect of my life. This is one of the aspects, that's it. I didn't fall in love in my surrogate, it wasn't the aim, I was married. It was just only to study the technique of how getting and to go to the goal. I took it as a very logical thing that I have to do.
He blames Western hang-ups about sex for any misconceptions people might have.
Sex is part of life. It's. I feel embarrassed to have. It's part of life. It's the satisfaction of life. It's not that I'm being Casanova. This is not the issue.
It's my pleasure to introduce you all, Ronnie Taloni.
Thank you very much. And I'm going to share the screen. Fine. So, good evening.
Ronit's giving an online lecture to a global group of sexologists, and I'm being allowed to listen in. They're from Holland, Brazil, Greece, and everywhere in between. She tells them about her experience and studies suggesting surrogacy is more effective than classical psychological therapy at treating sexual problems.
And this is most interesting. Those therapists who did already work with surrogate, all of them said that they will do it again. So, and I think
what fascinates me about the webinar is how little professionals in other countries knew about sex surrogacy. I want to know, what's special about Israel? How did it become so accepted here?
I think Israel is a very family-oriented country and very children-oriented country. And so we understand that you need sexuality to become a family and to have children. And it perceived as the first human right. I mean, you cannot take it away from anybody. That's why I think Israel is so positive about it.
When Ronit started out, she did rehab work in the religious kibbutzim, Israel's collective communities traditionally based around farming. The rabbis overseeing them approved her surrogacy techniques.
And they said, fine, the only restriction is that you cannot employ married women. So immediately we said, no married women, no married men, and we launched the program.
But she was determined to push it further.
We started the program in 1989. We work under the carpet for 2 years. Then I presented the first group of patients and the first group of surrogate in Amsterdam in 1991. That was a world sexology conference. I exposed it there, and since then it was out in Israel. We published it, and the journals were talking about it, programs in TV, whatever. And then in 1996, we got the permission of the Ministry of Defense.
Ronit has gone on to help dozens more badly injured soldiers.
We are in a war situation all the time, I think, since the country was established. And we lost so many young people. Everybody in Israel knows people who were injured or died or was affected by the army in a bad way. So then everybody has a positive approach to compensate these people. And we feel obliged to them. We feel that our independence depends on them. And we feel that the army are really taking care of us to be here, to stay here. This is our life.
Two more Israeli soldiers are captured, this time by Hezbollah militants in Lebanon. Israel says it's an act of war. Fighting's already broken out with militants on the border.
Back in the hot midsummer of 2006, the Lebanon war erupted suddenly after Hezbollah killed 8 Israeli soldiers and captured 2 in a cross-border raid. Israel quickly called up its reservists.
In the bloody month-long conflict, nearly 1,200 Lebanese people, mostly civilians, were killed, and over 160 Israelis, most of them soldiers. On both sides, many more were injured. A couple of those wounded Israeli soldiers went on to become Ronit's patients. One, whom we're calling David, had a severe brain injury that left him unable to move or speak.
Because of the pandemic, David's being very careful about his health and he's not coming into Tel Aviv. But he has agreed to let me go to visit him at his house to interview him about sex surrogacy. I'm standing in the garden with my face mask on, and you can probably hear a neighbour's chickens clucking. David's a tall guy. He's a short distance away in his wheelchair with his occupational therapist, Vered, who's dressed in a protective gown. She's got a visor over her face mask. The only way David can communicate is by using a small whiteboard that's balanced across his lap.
I hold his hand and arm up and support the pen. And David moves his hand forwards and backwards and creates letters. But he can't do it if I'm not holding it. He's unable to move his arm independently. He's unable to move it against gravity. And we call it facilitated writing. We've practiced this for the last 12 years.
So now it will be Vered that reads out David's words, edited together to save time. I begin by asking David about his life before he was called up as a reserve soldier in 2006.
I was just an ordinary person. I just got back from a trip in the Far East. I was studying in university and I worked as a barman, as a bartender. I used to love sports and friends.
What can you tell me about what happened to you during the war?
I was with my unit in Lebanon and a rocket fell close to us. I was blown up in the air and then my leg hurt. They didn't notice I had a brain injury because my leg was so badly wounded. When the helicopter arrived, I lost consciousness. And then I woke up in Rambam Hospital. When I first woke up, I couldn't understand what people were saying to me. Gradually, I began to understand more and more.
In total, David spent 3 years in hospital.
It was exhausting. It was treatments all day and lots of noise. I kept waiting to come back home.
How did the idea of surrogate partner therapy come up?
It came up through my occupational therapists. They knew another soldier who was injured during the army and he had surrogate treatments. I was very lucky.
What difference did it make for you?
When I started the surrogate therapy, I felt like a loser, like nothing. In therapy, I started feeling a man, young and handsome. It was the first time I felt that since my injury. It gave me strength and it gave me hope. Until then, all I wanted to do was to die.
But this was an intimate relationship that David started knowing that it would have to end. I want to know how that felt. Was he afraid of getting hurt emotionally?
Initially, it was difficult for me because I wanted the surrogate all to myself. But I realized that even if we're not partners, we're still good friends. And it's worth it. It's worth everything. It just helps you rebuild yourself all over again.
While the usual rules are that surrogates and patients can't be in contact outside of the therapy, David and his surrogate, a woman who uses the alias Serafina, were given special permission to stay in touch when their sessions ended. After years, when David told those close to him that all he wanted was to die, since the treatment, he's been focused on plans for the future. Before COVID-19 made it impossible, he'd begun socialising more, going out with the help of his carers. I'm curious to talk to David's surrogate, Serafina, so she's coming by train to Tel Aviv. She's slim with bobbed hair and is warm and articulate. Like all of the surrogate partners at the clinic, she has another job. Hers is in the arts. After more than a decade of working with Ronit, she's written a book called More Than a Sex Surrogate. She says she took up the role for altruistic reasons.
All those people that suffer under the ground and have all those hidden secrets that they walk around with, the thought that they are ashamed of who they are or the situation they are, I really, really wanted to help because I knew I had the ability. I had no problem with the idea using sexuality or my body or touch in the therapy process. And the subject was fascinating to me. Sexuality was fascinating to me.
How do you describe what you do?
Normally it's said that it's like I am a partner of the patient. I think I'm not just a partner. I am like a tour guide that is going to an adventure, to a trip with someone that I know the way and he doesn't know the way. I had patients that I said, let's say that we go to the Amazonas and you know nothing about it. So you can be eaten by a snake on the way. But if I know the way, I will guide you. We're going together.
Serafina's worked with about 40 patients, including another soldier. But she says that the severity of David's injuries posed a unique challenge. She learned how to do facilitated writing so that they could talk privately.
David is the most extreme case ever known. And it was like walking in a desert. You had no idea the direction, where to go. It was more trying to be intimate with somebody that nobody even knew what he felt. Does he feel his body at all? I had to be very, very creative because he doesn't move at all. I tried to imagine a young man, what he would want to happen. How was he before? And I used his brain because the brain remembered, but the body was a total loss. He felt his body, but he could not move it anyway. So I moved his body as if I imagined he would have moved his body if he could. And then I also learned how to communicate with him, which was very hard at first. But he always claimed that I feel him. He always said, she knows exactly what I want, even if I don't say anything. So it was really flattering.
I wonder how she deals with her own feelings, including saying goodbye to people she's been so intimate with.
I did fall in love not many times, maybe two, maybe three. But now I know it's for a short time, and I say it's like going to a vacation or we have an opportunity to have a wonderful relationship and for a certain short time. And do we give it up or we take it? It's an experience of life. We never know when the relationship actually is going to end. We know, so we can prepare. And it's the happiest breakup anybody can have. It's for good reasons, and I can cry sometimes, but at the same time, I'm so happy. And when I hear that anybody is in relationship or had a baby or got married, it's inimaginable how happy and thrilled and thankful I am for what I do, that it could happen, that it happens.
So I'm back at the clinic. It's on an ordinary street in Tel Aviv, a mixture of offices around here, apartments with families living in them.
But as I head up to the reception on the first floor, I reflect on how some extraordinary things happen inside these walls. And they've made me question a lot of my preconceived ideas, not just about surrogacy and sex therapy, but about sexual relationships in general. Ronit smiles knowingly when I tell her.
It's about sexuality. It's not that we know how to joke about sexuality. We know how to humiliate people about sexuality. We know to be very conservative about sexuality or too extreme about sexuality. It's never really balanced. It's never weaved into our life in the way it's supposed to be. And sexuality, it's our life. It's life. It's our connection with life. Through sexuality, we bring life, right? It's nature.
Runit trains young therapists and tries to convince those abroad that sex surrogacy could work for their clients. With modern surgery helping more severely wounded soldiers to survive, she says surrogate treatment could be of wider use. What can other countries learn from what you do here?
That you cannot rehabilitate a person without rehabilitating their self-esteem, their perception of their being a man or a woman. You cannot ignore this part in our life. It's a very important, powerful, it's the center of our personality. And you cannot just talk about it. Sexuality is something dynamic, is something that has to be between us and other people.
That's all from this edition of Assignment and me, Yolande Nell. The producer was Phil Marzouk.